All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we really do have a packed show for you this week. I think you're going to really appreciate it, too. All right, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with writer, director, actor Matt Ross. Now, some of you may know him from Silicon Valley, the TV series he's in, but others may know him from his work in film. And that includes, actually most recently, a film called Captain Fantastic, which he is the writer and director of, and it's starring Viggo Mortensen. And you'll hear more about that as we get to that segment of the show. But stick around because it's a really interesting film and it's one you're going to really want to hear about. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix. Carl is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're going to be talking about what has been going on in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota and what's been going on in the whole rest of the country as the struggle around police murder builds. And how are we going to get rid of not only police murder, but all of the other things that plague humanity in this society. But opening the show up,
I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show somebody that hasn't been on this show for a very long time. Okay, I'll say it again, a very long time. He used to be on here a lot more often. And his name is Joey Johnson. And anyone who's ever studied U.S. constitutional law and free speech has heard of Joey Johnson. He was the central figure in a legal and political battle with national and international reverberations around the right to burn the U.S. flag as a form of protest. He was arrested for burning the flag back in 1984. And a Supreme Court decision that said that burning the flag was constitutionally protected was the case that the government mounted against Joey Johnson. This has come up again in an extremely important case. On July 4th, actually, very, very, very appropriate, a man named Brighton Mellott, basically 22 years old, lives in Urbana, Illinois, and he posted on Facebook a picture of himself burning an American flag on the 4th of July. And he said he was not proud to be an American because of the atrocities committed against people of color, people living in poverty, people who identify as women, and against my own queer community on a daily basis. And he posted that he would like to one day feel a sense of pride towards his nationality again, but too little progress has been made. Too many people suffer at the hands of politicians influenced by special interests. Too many people are still being killed and brutalized by a police force plagued with authority complexes and racism. Too many people are allowed to be slaughtered for the sake of gun manufacturer profits. Too many Americans hold hate in their hearts in the name of their religion and for fear of others. And that's only to speak of domestic issues. I do not have any pride in my country. I'm overwhelmingly ashamed, and I will demonstrate my feelings accordingly. And he decided, hashtag arrest me. And he was arrested and held until they were forced to release him. And basically, they were forced to release him because of the decision in the Joey Johnson case around burning the flag back in the 80s. And I thought it'd be really appropriate to have Joey come on and talk with us some about this. Joey, how are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too, man. Well, let's jump into this. First off, why don't you talk to people about what did you think in relation to Brighton Mellott and what he did and its relationship to what you did?
Well, I was excited to hear about it. It was inspiring, and including the whole spirit of defiance of him doing that on July the 4th itself meant a lot. You just read the statement that he made on his Facebook posting about it. And I just think that there's much that large mind in terms of looking at the outrages that are committed in the name of patriotism and in the name of the American flag, things that he's disgusted with in society that he can't coincide with and tolerate. And there's a lot that's admirable and great in that. So I definitely send a shout out to him.
Well, let's talk about what you did. I think it's important for people to look back on this, or people who haven't heard of it. I mean, there's a whole lot of people who may not have even heard of your case. And I'd like you to talk about what happened and the significance of it.
Well, my charges came back in the 1980s, and they arose out of a protest at the Republican National Convention in Dallas, Texas in 1984, where Ronald Reagan was being renominated for his second term as president, or the American Führer for the time. And there was a lot of folks, and you know, myself included, that felt like it was necessary to make the trek to Dallas. These political conventions are very choreographed and very scripted. And the theme of that convention was American renewal, renewing the sense of American accomplishment. Like, Reagan was the first president in the aftermath of the Vietnam War to kind of boldly project that unashamed patriotism, unashamed American resurgence of American pride and all this. So we felt the need to go there and to oppose that, expose it, condemn it as vibrantly as we could. And The city was all decked out like a Nuremberg rally, and the flags were everywhere. And look, I just got to say that the flag to me is not a symbol of any kind of liberty and justice. No, it's a symbol of profound injustice. It's a symbol of international plunder and murder. It's a symbol that's presided over countless wars for empire and slaughters and invasions and coup d'etats and massacres, going back to the American flag being carried by the cavalry when it massacred indigenous people at Wounded Knee, when it was the flag that was stenciled on the planes that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I could just go on and on all day. And these are all outrages that people shouldn't tolerate. But they are done in the name of America. And the flag, regardless of people's individual sentimentality, it's a symbol of the system, of the government, of the empire. And that's what we went to Dallas to oppose. And at the time, I was a supporter, and I still am, of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a follower of Bob Avakian. And Avakian had said way back then in the 1980s, he was an ardent internationalist. There was a quote from him that people can check out that's still in the book Basics from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And this was what was guiding my thinking, was if you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations, and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sight to anything less? That was the consciousness of the thinking that motivated me to go to Dallas to protest. And as I said, there were flags displayed everywhere, and in the course of a whole raucous protest of hundreds of youth through downtown Dallas, some of those flags got, shall we say, removed. And at the end of our protest, we burned one in defiance of the whole America Uber Alles theme that was kind of belching out of the convention. And look, nowadays people want to get all sentimental about Reagan, but look, Reagan was the president at the time of the U.S.'s invasion of Grenada. He backed the Contras who massacred people in Nicaragua. He backed the death squads that massacred people in El Salvador and Guatemala. He made jokes about starting nuclear war with the then Soviet Union. He was a monster in the service of imperialism or this resurgent imperialism. So anyways, I got popped for it. I got arrested and I got charged and I got convicted in Dallas, Texas, and sentenced to a year in jail and a $2,000 fine. And we appealed my conviction and fought the case for 5 years all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I really do think they wanted to reinstate my conviction because it had gotten overturned at a lower court level in Texas. But the Supreme Court, I think, was out to reinstate it. But then we waged a whole political battle at the Supreme Court level. And my lawyer was the famed William Kunstler. But we waged a political campaign and a legal campaign to get people to understand the stakes, that this would be a form of forced patriotism of the government compelling you to respect the flag, and that people should not go along with that, regardless of their political stance of whether they were radical or liberal or revolutionary or whatever, you know, that they should take a stand against forced patriotism. But within that, I want to bring out that, like Bob Avakian says, internationalism, the whole world comes first. That's what we all need to be about.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Joey Johnson, the infamous flag burner who went to the Supreme Court and won. That means he got a ruling that burning the flag was, in fact, legal.
Let me ask you this, Joey, because we only have a short period of time here, but I really wanted to make sure that we talk about this. In an interview you did a little while back, you talked about how one of the things that was behind this was the fact that the powers that be that want the masses of people to have political amnesia about what this system does to people around the world and what this flag stands for. When you talk to people around the world, and I've seen it myself in places I've gone around the world where people see that flag, but it goes up against the same thing of seeing how the U.S. operates in these various countries. You made the point that that real history is inconvenient history for the ruling class, and that they want people here and around the world to see something wholesome in the red, white, and blue, and the whole patriotism commercials, the imperial system, the empire, and the flag it represents, and all that stuff. They want to paint a whole different picture than the reality of it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we were going to talk about it in detail, we would need a show that would last 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 years to list all of the atrocities, all the crimes, all the invasions, all the coup d'etats, all the massacres, the nuclear incineration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what I described earlier about the flags being stenciled on the bombs or stenciled on the planes that dropped these horrific weapons on the people there. What we're dealing with is a system of imperialism. And let's just look at recent history and how the U.S. has laid waste to a whole arc of countries from Afghanistan to Tunisia, from Somalia to Iraq, and now Syria, where it's all about empire, and it's sickening and it's disgusting. And they want us to have amnesia, but now they want to talk about ISIS, but they want us to have amnesia about what they've done to the lives of millions of people in the Middle East. The devastation, the outright murder by bombs, or now the drones under Obama, the outright destruction of whole countries, the Iraqi people having lost more than a million souls to U.S. imperialism trying to impose its will for the oil, power, and the empire, as we say. And now that's spreading into Syria and the imperialist rivalry that's going on there between Russia and the U.S. over who's going to dominate that whole region. It's hideous, you know? And yeah, they want to, oh, that's so 15 minutes ago. That's so 5 years ago. People have amnesia about the upheaval and the dislocation. Millions of people happen to be refugees. Now Europe is confronting the largest refugee crisis in its history or since World War II. Overwhelmingly, the guilt, the responsibility for that should be at the doorstep of U.S. imperialism. And people have to understand this, that patriotism means putting your country first. And Bob Avakian talks about how these ideas are really outmoded. They're holding back humanity. We got to be about how we're going to emancipate humanity. That's what I take an active orientation towards. And I'm part of the Revolution Club, which works with the Revolutionary Communist Party and takes leadership from it. And we are ardently promoting internationalism and standing with the people of the world. And Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism, there's a whole other way that humanity can live. You know, I'm sick every time I hear a presidential speech by Obama or any other president where the last words out of their mouth after each speech is, and God bless America. Well, number one, there's not a God. But if there were, why would that God be so concerned about the United States of America? It's just that narrowness of capital personified, where they have to approach everything from the standpoint of how is it going to fit the agenda and the requirements and the imperatives of their imperialist capital, their aggregate of capital that's organized around a national market and a flag, a symbol of that empire, and train people in that narrowness and train people not to think about the well-being of humanity and where is humanity going. And that's what Bob Avakian has been focused. So I think people got to break out of their comfort zone and check out revcom.us. Check out the Revolution newspaper site and find out about these crimes of imperialism that we've been talking about that the system wants to hide from them. I just came out of the streets last night. I know you're going to have Carl Dixon in a few minutes to talk about the struggle down in Baton Rouge and the struggle in Minnesota over police terror. This is another crime of this system. Patriotism, patriarchy, male supremacy, white supremacy, these are all values that are entrenched in this system and that all need to be swept away. And we're building a movement for revolution. We talk about it's time to get organized for an actual revolution to overthrow this system that thrives on and is enslaving people all over the world and is causing so much unnecessary suffering. But we do have to get to the root of it. And the root of it is this whole capitalist imperialist system, and that there's a vision and a leadership to organize humanity in a whole different way that BA has been working on. And I really encourage your listeners to get into it and find out more about it and join with us.
All right, Joey Johnson, thank you very much for joining us again, man.
Thank you. Take care, Michael.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Joey Johnson, the infamous, the famous flag burner, the guy who burned a flag, went up and fought the whole U.S. system and won, the Supreme Court having to uphold the right to burn a flag. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dix, so stay tuned. right, welcome back. That's Hell You Talking About. And it's an incredibly important song for the times, all right? An incredibly important song for what's going on, what continues to go on, and what necessitates people getting their eyes open, their heads clear, and understanding what's going on and what's needed. And to help us in doing that, I welcome back Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome back to the show, man.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. It's good to have you on one level, so we can understand all this stuff. It's also, on another level, it's not so good to have you on every week when we're talking about the endless plague of murders. And just this week, watching as people all over the country, all over the world, watched the cold-blooded murders of Alton Sterling, murdered in Baton Rouge, and Philando Castile, murdered in Minnesota. And just clearly, no question about it. In either one of those cases, nobody can ever say, well, there's two sides. It's a little shady. This was straight up murder. Let's talk about that for a minute, man.
Yeah, and see, this is very important because, yes, you watched the execution of Alton Sterling. You saw the cops come and beat him down and kneeling on his arms and pulling out a gun and shooting him in his chest multiple times. And you saw the aftermath of the murder of Brother Castile, Philando Castile, up in Minnesota. What we have to remember, though, is that this system goes to work to exonerate killer cops who do that kind of stuff again and again and again. Because we saw the murders of Tamir Rice and Eric Garner. We know those went down. There was no question about it. But those killer cops have been exonerated, and they're working on exonerating these two, and this must not be allowed to happen. People were and are very right and righteous to go into the streets in Baton Rouge, where I am right now, and to be in the streets up in Minnesota. Can't be there because, you know, we ain't got cloning working yet, but I am in this fight, and it's very important. Look, I watched that video of the sister in Minnesota. The cops have just murdered her partner, and the cop is holding a gun on her. The murderer is holding a gun on the loved one of the victim and telling her what she needs to do, and she's responding, yes, sir. And you get a sense of what's going on here is to keep myself from being murdered. Like my lover just got murdered, I have to follow this cop's orders, and I have to call this cop sir. And it takes you back to the slave chasers. It takes you back to Jim Crow and black people having to step off the sidewalk for white people. And today it's still going on, only it's the cops playing that role in relation to suppressing and savagely oppressing black people. And look, it's got to stop. An important part of it is people being in the streets and saying in loud voices that are unmistakably clear, this must stop. But look, if we're going to end this, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, because this isn't the first time we've had clear evidence of police murdering people. I mentioned Eric Garner. I mentioned Tamir Rice. I could have mentioned Rakia Boyd. There are many names we could have talked about, and those cops got off. So we need to fight for justice in each and all of these cases, but we got to go beyond that and make that fight for justice part of making revolution and getting rid of a system that does this. And that's why it's critical that we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are organizing right now for an actual revolution, one that overthrows this system and puts a totally different and far better one in its place.
Now, Carl, sort of touching on that, but stepping back a little bit, I wanted to ask you this, because a lot of people I know, people I've spoken to over the last few days, they're agonizing over this question. Why the hell does this keep happening? It's sort of like you look at it, there's not a week that goes by that there isn't something outrageous. And these two things were particularly outrageous, but it's like actually people looking at it saying, what the hell is it? Why? Why does it keep happening? And they're looking for that answer. What is it?
Yeah, I think there's a quote from Bob Avakian on the role of the police, which points you right to it. And that is, the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people, but to protect and serve the system that rules over the people, to keep in effect its relations of exploitation and oppression. That's what the police are out there to do. And as long as this system is in effect, it's going to keep those frontline enforcers out there doing that. It really stems from the nature of this system and how it operates and the role and conditions it enforces on people. And today, with the way that imperialism has developed and globalized, there are, in the inner cities across the country, large numbers of people that the system literally has no future for. They don't require them to be exploited in their factories or other manufacturing ventures. And what they have for those people are mechanisms of control, cops, court, prison, and early graves. And those are the conditions that these frontline enforcers are enforcing. And the way that they do that is through instilling terror, so that the murder of an Alton Sterling or a Philandro Castile is a message to everybody else that it could happen to you, so stay in your place. Just like the lynchings that happened back in the day of black people for any real or imagined violation of the codes of Jim Crow were a message to all other black people that this could be done to them and they should stay in their place.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about police murder, what happened in Minnesota and Baton Rouge just recently, and what's it going to take to stop all this once and for all?
You know, there was something I was reading earlier today on RevCom.us, and it talked about the gunshots and tasers of today are no different than the slave chains and whips of the past, no different than the lynching rope and the KKK terror. And it's really soaked in the blood of our people here and around the world. This is something that really, in terms, I think, that what you're speaking to, this system's power and their armed forces of violent suppression really can't be sort of played with. They can't be sort of, let's figure out a way we can work for survival of both. This stuff has to be wiped out. I'd ask you to comment on that, especially in terms of this, of like, what are people to do today?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised this for two reasons. One is people do need to go to the website revcom.us. There have been a few new statements up this week following the murder of Alton Sterling, then another following the murder of Philandro Castile. And then there's even one that went up in just the past few minutes. And this is important because there's an attempt to change the conversation, you know, in light of things that have happened in Dallas. And one thing that that statement says that's very important is that the question was and should continue to be, why do police get away with wantonly murdering people? And part of its answer is that it's built into the fabric of this system, been there historically, and we need an actual revolution, one that overthrows this system, gets rid of it, and puts a whole new and far better system in its place. Because we should live in a world where those who are entrusted with public security would sooner risk or lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. But in this world, that's upside down. And when the police brutalize or murder somebody, they get the benefit of the doubt, and the whole system goes into operation to exonerate them. This is another reason. It's far from the only one when you look at what this system does in this country and around the world. And that new statement that just went up on RevCom brings out the breadth and the depth of the horrors this system enforces on people around the world. But this horror by itself would be reason enough if the only thing it did wrong was the wanton murder of black and Latino people, especially, and native people by the police. That was the only thing it did wrong. That would be reason enough to get rid of it through revolution. And we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are organizing right now for an actual revolution. There is a proclamation from the party up on the website, revcom.us, that gets into what the problem is, what the solution is. It gets into the leadership that we have to make this solution of an actual revolution real, the strategic approach that that leadership has developed, and then it gets into principles that we live and die. We live, fight, and will even die around. And that is things like people not fighting and killing each other. And an important thing that's developed is developing here in Baton Rouge, which I've seen in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and even in Los Angeles a couple decades ago in situations where people rise up and fight back against their oppressors and the police, is that some of the young people who had been fighting and even killing each other are in the streets together here in Baton Rouge. Last night, well, actually into the morning, There were like hundreds of people, and a lot of them were young people. And some of the young men told us that they were from rival sets, that last week they saw their enemies as each other. Well, right now they're seeing a common enemy, and they're coming together to stand up right now in protest against that common enemy. But people need to not only get out of fighting and killing each other and stand together in protest, they need to get with this movement for revolution and the actual revolution that the Revolutionary Communist Party is organizing for, and be a part of bringing a whole different and far better future into being in the only way that's really possible, and that's through revolution.
All right, Carl, one last point, and that is, as just off of what you're saying, as part of doing that, when people are looking for a way to get involved, there's two questions, getting involved in things overall in terms of involved in a movement for revolution, but there's also some things about what do people do right now? Because a lot of people are looking at, what do I do right now? How do I stand up against this? How do I make my feelings heard? And how do I make a difference? And I'd like you to talk to that, and especially in relation to what does that have to do with this movement for revolution you're talking about?
Okay. It has everything to do with the movement for revolution, and I'll come back to that. But what people need to do right now, these pictures, these videos of police murdering people can play one of two roles. One role that they're playing right now is enraging people and motivating them to stand up. And people need to take to the streets. They need to take, look, I came down from New York City to Baton Rouge to be with people standing in this fight. If people can make that trip, do it. And look, work to get in touch with me. But if you can't do that, and they can get in touch with me by going through the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website and email address, which is up on the Stop Mass Incarceration website. You can't do that, then mobilize folks where you are. Take to the street. Say that this has to stop. Police can no longer be allowed to get away with murder, and take it to the streets and mean that. And we cannot let them think that they've lulled us to sleep and that they can keep doing this without there being a strong political response to it. And see, this has everything to do with organizing for an actual revolution right now, because if they can get away with murdering people like Brother Castillo in Minnesota, like Brother Sterling here in Baton Rouge, they will do it, they will continue to do it, and they will beat us down so far that people will be broken and unable to respond in any way. But on the other hand, and see, that's the other role that these things can play, because it can be a very frustrating and demoralizing thing to people if they see these murders happen and no one gets punished for it. It can then create a sense of, I guess there's nothing we can do and we have to put up with this forever. And that's part of the message coming out of the speech that Obama gave, where he bemoaned these killings by police, said police have a tough job. Look, it ain't that tough not murdering people. It ain't that tough not blowing people away for nothing. That's not that hard. But then he also said at the end, it's going to take a long time to deal with this. It might not happen in my children's lifetime. Well, that's the thing of saying you're going to have to put up with the stuff that we do to you forever. And we should not accept that. And see, people standing up, refusing to take this, actually helps to prepare the ground, prepare the situation for others to join in standing up. And that's very important for the prospects of making revolution, people standing up and fighting back. But that puts responsibility on those who see the need for revolution. And that responsibility is to tap into the desire to resist on a lot of people and to connect that with what's needed to stop this. And that's an actual revolution and organizing for an actual revolution right now. And that's what we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are doing. People who want to see that need to connect with the Revolution Club that's in the streets in New York City, in Chicago, and in L.A., in San Francisco, was in the streets in Baltimore when the trial of the cops who had murdered Freddie Gray were going on. And some of them are going to be down here in Baton Rouge. People need to get with the Revolution Club, join it in fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution, and get with this revolution. And they can do that by going to the website revcom.us. you got to go to that website regularly, every day, because there's always something new that's up there.
All right, Carl, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, and I'm sure I'll talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
All right, bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we've been talking about an extremely important question. What the hell is going on, and why is it going on, and what can we do to stop it? We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was a little bit more of Hell You Talking About from Janelle Monáe. On the last day of the Sundance Film Festival and the last film that I went to see, I just had my, you know, I don't know, my head was twirled around by forces that I didn't expect to encounter. I went to see a film that just really knocked me out, man. It was a film that was called Captain Fantastic, and it's a film about Ben Cash, who's played by Viggo Mortensen, and he's raising his 6 kids off the grid in rural Washington. And they kind of live in these structures that they built themselves. They hunt and they farm for all their own food. And they celebrate Noam Chomsky's birthday like it's Christmas. And one reviewer called Ben the sort of ideological-minded communist who hates greater capitalist culture of America and teaches his children 5 languages as well as a doctrine to stick it to the man, all of which really endeared the movie to my heart. I just couldn't get enough of it, and I was really eager to talk with the director and writer of the film, Matt Ross. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sure. All right, just we'll start with this. What the hell were you thinking about, man? You did this.
What I was thinking about was being a father, frankly. I have 2 kids. My daughter just turned 13 and my son is 8. And I was thinking, I was grappling with very much about the kind of parent I want to be. What do I want to pass to my children? I think that, you know, one of the greatest gifts we can give to our children is our full attention. And in this world of technology that we all exist in, we're pulled in many, many directions. And I sort of posited or fantasized about what it would be like to give up all my professional desires and devote myself entirely to my children, which is probably impossible, or certainly for me at this moment seems to be. And I wanted to sort of wrestle with that in a narrative form and see what it might look like. For me, the movie is very much about being a father and a parent in the contemporary United States.
It's interesting. When I saw the opening scene of the film, I have to tell you, for 1 minute, and I went into the film knowing very little about it. I purposely didn't look into, like, okay, what are people saying about it? What's going on with it? And I was sitting way...
Which is the best way to see a film, by the way.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Very hard to do.
Exactly. And I was sitting way up in the last row in Eccles. I was looking down. I'm thinking, all right, this is where I just want to really just have it just come out and wash over me. The first scene with the deer killing and the blood all over the place, I have to be honest, I fully expected Colonel Kurtz or the demon kids from the Lord of the Flies to come out and take over, but you took it someplace else entirely.
Well, I think that was intentional. I think the movie starts with a ritual. It's sort of a rite of passage where the boy becomes the man. But I liked the idea that when you're reading the script, and I think it proves true when you're watching the film, is for a moment you don't know what century you're in. I liked that. That was intentional.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, though, because it was also something when you, as you developed that whole scene, actually, I felt like, in a certain sense, I felt like this was a place that I kind of felt familiar with. And I was wondering, like, it's one thing to talk about you wanted to do this as a father. You wanted to do this as a parent, as someone who's actually got some children that you're responsible for, helping them walk through the world and learn how to walk through the world themselves. But it's also, there was more that was there in a certain sense, because you could have done that, and not saying that you would just because of your own artistic sensibilities, but, you know, look, there's people who did that with the Danny Thomas show decades ago, or people who could do it with some way that was far less impactful and meaningful than what you did with this. So where did that, actually the form of this come from in terms of the way you framed it?
Well, part of it is, it's not autobiographical, but my mother was a 70s, 80s hippie. The term hippie is obviously loaded, and I would say that she was too old to be a hippie of the Vietnam era. But she was interested in alternative ways of raising her children, and my brother and I, and she lived in England, and I lived in communal situations, they, you know, for lack of a better word, they were communes in Northern California, and she started one in Oregon. So, you know, at one point, we lived on some land that she had bought with some friends. They tended to be artisans, people who had wanted to raise their families outside of cities, and they bought communally owned this land, and there was at one point we had a teepee that was by a lake, and in the summer we would live in the teepee. So some of those things were the fabric of my life, but my mother is not Ben Cash, and I think it really came out of this question of what we teach our children. Children can navigate an iPad, but they certainly couldn't grow or hunt for their own food, and that's the most extreme example, I think, of our lack of ability to navigate the world. But no, I was really thinking about what it was I was teaching my children and what I wanted to pass to them. We hope, if you've lived on the earth for a certain amount of years, you hope you'll learn something, and you want to protect your children and help them navigate the world and prevent them from having to make the same mistakes you make. And I think I was really thinking about from a primal level, like, you know, what are we? What am I teaching my children? You know, we send our kids off to school and hope that they learn the truth. But we all know that, because we all went through the American school system, we know that there are many things that we learn that are myths, that is not true. And whether you're on the right or the left side of the political spectrum, I think people grapple with this. I was thinking about really wanting to lead my children away, and I thought the film also asks the question, is it possible to do this? And I don't want to answer it, because I think the film does address it in some way. I don't want to answer it here, that is. But I think the problem that is addressed in the film is that when you leave society, you're also existing away from it, and therefore you're not, in fact, navigating the world. And that's something that Ben does, that the family portrayed in the film, when they leave their compound or their home in the forest because of certain events that happen, they're confronted with that reality. It may be possible to exist outside of the world in a certain way, but once you have to deal with the world, it brings up other questions. It's something I deal with in my own family all the time. When I was a kid, it was, do you allow your children to watch television? Now it's, do you allow your children to play video games, to have iPods and iPhones and iPads? In some ways, it's easier to exist in the extremes and harder to exist in moderation and harder to, you know, allow a balance. That's mm-hmm. really hard.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with writer, actor, director, Matt Ross, and we're talking about his latest film, Captain Fantastic, which should be opening up in many parts of the country now, with more to come later.
You know, it's interesting too, you know, like when you were referring to your mom in communes, and I lived in urban communes, and mainly because at the time I wasn't going to go anywhere near anything wild that might see me just as a pork chop. I didn't want to end up that way. But one of the things that happened in my experience is that I had to come to grips with exactly somewhat what you're talking about. I had to come to grips with the thing of that, you know, no matter what I was doing, that the system that we lived in was actually conditioning. It was conditioning how we lived and how we thought. And I kept thinking, there were these friends of mine that they used to tell me they were not going to let their kids watch something like The Dukes of Hazzard, you know, and they were pushing
right,
that
right.
And saying, yeah, you know, we don't want any of that in here. We don't want any of that here. And so they would turn the televisions off. They'd put the televisions locked away in the closet or whatever. And yet these kids were running around outside with Dukes of Hazzard's T-shirts that they stole from their friends and decals were putting out.
No, my mother wouldn't allow us to eat sugar or watch television. And when we left these communal places that we lived in, and at one point I lived something like 8 miles from the nearest dirt road and 30 miles from a general store and an hour from the town, and the town was, or 2 hours from a town, and the town had 1,000 people in it. But once we left that community that she had started and we moved to an actual town of, I don't know, 14,000 people or something, the first thing you do is you run over to your friend's house, you eat all their sugared cereal and want to watch TV all day long, and because it's forbidden food. It's that balance that's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
My mother made attempts. I mean, I remember, you know, she regrets this. I don't regret it, but I remember we brought some goats onto our land, and we saw them slaughtered, which has been seared into my mind, that moment. She wanted us to be aware of our food source. I think she now realizes we were maybe too young to see that image, but you know, that's something that we all were around hundreds of years ago when we had to subsist on, you know, mm-hmm. We all had to subsist by either hunting for our own food or having animals.
So that opening scene in your film terrorized your mom, huh? It's like, it terrorized the hell out of me,
yeah,
man.
That's her punishment. I made her watch that. No, for me, that was much more a ritual, and I wanted it to be really that, you know, originally in the script, it was that he felled the deer with a perfect kill shot, which is very hard to do with an arrow, but just the logistics of portraying that on the budget we had, and you really have to build an animatronic deer or have special effects of a level that was beyond us. And also, it's unless you're a hunter, you wouldn't necessarily understand a perfect kill shot, whereas if someone could actually take down an animal with a knife, that's something that I think that people could clearly identify as a great degree of skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because, you know, as we're talking, and I know your emphasis on, you know, your children and the rest of this, but something that struck me that was the film was really big to me in terms of a big heart and a big embrace of these huge questions that humanity in general is facing these days. We live in a terrible, terrible, you know, atmosphere today. You know, if you're unlucky enough to have been born someplace in the third world, you know, you're not going to live very long, or you'll live a life of total misery. But what you seem to be wrestling with to a certain extent there, or playing with and wrestling with how this would function and what you would do, is that idea of there has to be a better way for humans to live with each other. And even though it was interesting because you did it in a way where you're dealing with a small family, relatively small family, and they're cut off from a lot of the rest of society, but it posed such universal questions for humanity as a whole right now. I was really, really intrigued by that.
Well, I think, I'm not sure I'm going to address directly your question, but there's two things I'd say about that. One, I hoped to portray what I saw as three cultures within the United States of America. I mean, there are many Americas within the United States of America, which we're in the political season, and we all see that. We see, I mean, we are a two-party system, which is a pretty, I think to me, is not as highly functioning as parliamentary democracy, and it's unfortunate because I lived in Italy, and, you know, and I remember when I was living in Italy, there was a far, far left communist party, and there was a far, far right fascist party, and they were both part of the government and part of the conversation, and our two-party system doesn't really bridge the gap of American political thought, and not entirely, obviously. That's another conversation. But what I was trying to do is portray with openness and humanity, I guess, three different cultures within the United States, which was, one, this kind of off-the-grid culture, which can be either far left or far right, or just left or right, depending on where you find it. The sort of middle-class suburban American culture, which most Americans exist in. And then, finally, the sort of golf club or gated community culture of certain wealthy conservative pockets in America. And I wanted to show different ways of raising children within those environments. And then again, the next thing I'd say about that is I think psychically I was just at a place in my life where I wanted to make a piece of work, piece of art that was hopeful and generous and that could actually be life-affirming in a non-treacly way. So much of our entertainment, certainly when it's corporate entertainment, I feel is emotionally manipulative and has no center. There's no there. But if some pieces of work that are meaningful to me, if they can earn that sentimentality, if they can evoke or provoke an emotional response in me that's earned and have a genuine hopeful nature, then I think there's something kind of spiritually affirming about that, and I was wanting to do that. I don't always want to do that. Certainly as a young man, I was drawn to very dark things, and I felt that there was an authenticity in darkness. But for this particular film, I was looking for something that was, you know, I thought, is it possible to make a film that's life-affirming and have it be authentic at the same time. It didn't make me feel, I don't know, cheated or manipulated. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
certainly part in something I was thinking about.
Yeah, we're getting to it. You know, part of the thing I was thinking about, too, the way you did that in this film, which, you know, look, you can't watch your film. I mean, it's incredible. You're sitting there and you're watching it, and you're watching the way the relations between the family members roll out, the way they respect and love one another, and also the way the contradictions that are coming up. And the fact that it was very heavy, because even what you concentrated on focusing on, the terms of the intellectual discourse, the teaching these kids to be thoughtful and analytical, and to also to care about. I mean, there's some of the greatest scenes when you have the father telling the young guy about what he should and shouldn't do when he has relations with a woman. And it's sort of, there's all this stuff that he's trying to train everybody to do everything really great and in a humanitarian way. And yet there's another thing operating just by virtue of the fact that you're existing, even if you live in the middle of the woods, you're existing in a society like this overall. And it has an impact on people, I think, in terms of what you portrayed even there, right?
That's true. I mean, because again, that goes back to the fact that they're existing apart from society, and eventually the children are going to have to, they're going to either continue to live in the woods away from society for their entire existence, or they're going to have to attempt at some point to become part of society. And that changes everything. They have certain skills and they clearly lack others. I also think, just like being a parent, there is this idea that being a parent is ultimately impossible insofar as your children grow up and they leave. And you are required, look, my children are young, so they haven't left the nest yet, but at some point they are going to leave, and I will probably always feel like I want to be able to protect them, and yet they'll be adults and they will be outside of my control. I will probably never feel like they're safe or that they can function but without my help, but they will leave and they will become their own people, and I will have to let go. And part of, I think, the journey of the movie certainly is that he's having to let go. As the oldest son is now 17, 18, 19, he's going to leave home. And that is the beginning of the end of him as a father for all the children. They're all going to follow that. As I think the boy says, we're not all just going to live with you forever. And I think that's part of his journey, is coming to the realization that at some point he has to let go. He's holding on so very tight, trying to protect them. His very desire to protect them, and in some ways is doing them a great disservice.
Exactly. I think that's really true. And it's really true, and it actually comes through a lot in the film. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with writer, actor, director Matt Ross, and we're talking about his latest film, Captain Fantastic, which should be opening up in many parts of the country now, with more to come later. You know, one of the things I wanted to say to people, too, that when you're watching Captain Fantastic, you're watching it, and it's not, you know, we're having a discussion about these bigger questions right now, but there's actually, I mean, it's really interesting because, all right, I'll admit it, I'm a crybaby, okay? And when there's that much deep emotional stuff going on, you can't help it. And I wasn't, and I know, you know, however many thousands were in that theater at Sundance, everybody was crying, okay? But there was also a lot of laughter and a lot of joy. And there was stuff that you brought into that that I thought was just like jarring contradictions. And I'll just name one because, and people, if they've read any review of it all, they've seen this. The one about celebrating not Christmas, but Noam Chomsky's birthday and having that song come out. But it was that kind of humor, that kind of thing that kept pushing at the basic humanity that the people in that family had and the relationships they had with each other. But also there was, again, that still that what you're talking about, that no matter how hard you try, there are things in society that are pulling on people and that you've got to let kids go, you know. And so there was a lot of humor in it, but there was a lot of just sort of wrenching thinking going on around in terms of, how do you do this? How do you send kids out in the world? You got to trust what you've trained them in, but you also got to trust their ability to actually seek out what the truth is in society overall.
Well, certainly that was a hope of mine, that the film would be funny and sad and funny and sad and funny and sad and always true. I think that I go to movies hoping for an intellectual and an emotional experience, and usually I get one. Rarely I get both, but certainly the goal for this film specifically was both. I wanted to have something that was thought-provoking and that you'd leave and think about and self-reflect, but also while you're having the journey of the film, you could laugh and cry. I mean, I want that when I go see films. I want to care. I want to be invested, and I want to be moved. I want to be taken to another world and have a, like I said, an emotional and an intellectual reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if I achieve that in any way, that's good.
Yeah,
good.
Congratulations, man. You did with me. That's for sure. You know,
Thank you.
You know, one thing I do think that...
I'm glad.
Yeah. I do think that one of the things that really gets me is that it's, again, you leave the film feeling not like there's been a decisive turn one way or the other, but that there's actually been a solution that's been developed to a certain extent. And to me, it was really important that you did that because it was just so much was posed, so much was concentrated there. The fact that there wasn't an easy out, that there wasn't just sort of the Cinderella story or the whatever was going on. There was actually some ways that people had to come to grips with the society they live in, but also not give up the basic principles that they were brought up with. And that's really important and not enough in the society today.
Well, that's good. I mean, I don't think he gives up his values. I think without giving away the ending, I think he makes certain changes in his life, but he does not give up his values. He's not somehow been beaten down or defeated. I think he's found a way, perhaps a more healthy way, to protect his children.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't probably change. Some things change, but most things remain the same, or at least the important things remain the same.
Mm-hmm. Beyond protecting his children, because this is something that I think you've gone through with your kids, I know I went through with my son, you're not just protecting him. There's a certain role for protection, but you're also trying to equip people, kids in particular, and as they grow older, with the ability to analyze the world, to think for themselves, and to make judgments
that'll
make a difference, you know?
Right. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well said.
Now, I have one more question for you, all right? What inspired you to come up with the line that I have heard anybody who's seen this film? All right, and I'm walking around the party afterwards at the closing night party at Sundance. I'm walking around that, and I'll go up to somebody and I'll say, I saw you at the film. I saw this afternoon. I look at them and they say, "Power to the people!" Right? And what's the response, brother?
Oh, stick it to the man.
Yeah, don't say. You have to say, "Stick it to the man."
So I live in Berkeley. My wife is from Berkeley, mm-hmm. and I'm raising my kids in Berkeley, and my daughter was over at some friend's house, and they're my age, and he came home one day, and I think he was like four or five, and he was saying, "Power to the people, stick it to the man," over and over again. And I know it's a 70s, you know, slogan or anthem, and it's somewhat antiquated in its as a phrase, I suppose. But you collect these things as you're writing something. There's this sort of the structure of the plot and the character development, but then it becomes this vast tapestry where little things are added along, like the proverbial rock rolling down and collecting moss. It collects little ideas, then become little runners throughout the narrative. And that was just something that at some point I just thought, it came from my personal life, and I just thought it was funny because I'd heard it before, certainly, but when my four-year-old was saying it at the time, I guess he was four, I just thought it seemed so humorous to me.
And
I liked the sentiment.
Was he wearing a leather jacket and a beret? I just want to know.
He was not.
Yeah.
He should have been.
You know,
but I make my kids celebrate Noam Chomsky Day because Noam is one of my heroes. And that was something that we celebrate Noam Chomsky Day and have for years. And I think that everyone should. And to me, he's somewhat of a hero and a voice in a vast wilderness. And I've learned so much from him. And I think, so I put that in the script because I just thought, well, they would too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the things about the power to the people, stick it to the man, the way that comes out is it actually offers, it really gives a certain baseline measurement of the sentiment of the film overall, which is kind of like, this is a terrible world. There's a lot of bad forces in it, but you know what? Power to the people, stick it to the man is something that captured a lot, even if you just did it as sort of like, you liked it for your whatever reason, but it really captured something in terms of the ethos, you know?
No, I am glad to hear that. And I was aware that I thought it might have a resonance as well. So I was hoping it would land more than just a little humorous catchphrase. You know, I thought it definitely represented Ben's credo.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly. All right, Matt Ross, thank you very much for joining us today.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having
me. All right, we've just been talking with writer, actor, director Matt Ross, and Matt is the writer and director of the new film Captain Fantastic, which is opening up now across the country. Don't miss it, folks. It's really, really a mind bender. And it's just going to grab your heart. It's going to have you crying, laughing, and wanting to see it again. All right. So don't miss it. And on that note, I want to thank all of my guests today. Joey Johnson, Carl Dix, and Matt Ross. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson.
my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and Matt Kwiklinski, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with something I think is just extremely appropriate for the theme of today's show, and that is just a little bit more of Janelle Monáe's Hell You Talkin' 'Bout. Talk to you again next week.
Say his name, say his name, say his name, say his name, won't you say his name?